please help me welcome and thank Guy Gordon and Tim Sloan.
So I'm already going to apologize. My questions won't be nearly as insightful as the students that we had earlier. All right? I do want to do this. This is the toughest question you're going to get, and it's going to be tough because you have to reach into the way, way back machine. Okay. Your dad is here.
Yes.
He took you to the Detroit Economic Club when you were a youth, didn't he?
He did not, but he would come to these meetings.
Okay. I was, and impart what he learned.
He did. I learned a lot of, and one of the reasons that I have been as successful as I have been is because of those two people right there.
Yeah. And it was a pleasure meeting you. So I think it's safe to say that Wells Fargo and Detroit have this in common.
Mm-hmm.
We're both midway through a transformation.
Yep.
And you have a unique perspective, being a hometown guy, mm-hmm. Understanding our history, but also having left and the perspective of distance.
Right.
When you've come back, what impresses you about what's happening in Detroit?
Oh, I think it's the resiliency of the city. We have a number of very good customers, many of whom, by the way, are in the audience. Thank you very much for the relationships that you have with Wells Fargo. But we do a lot of business here, and so I have the opportunity to come back and see our customers and see our team. We have about 950 team members that work here in Michigan. And what's just impressed me is the commitment to the city, whether it's the mayor, what the mayor has done, how he's coordinated with civic leaders. I mean, what's been done in terms of reinvestment in residential, in hospitality, and just the functions of the city. I mean, it's incredible when I think about what it was like 5 years ago and 10 years ago. And I think it's a real model in terms of what can be done in urban areas around this country that are struggling just as much as the city of Detroit was struggling.
In terms of the general economy, mm-hmm. we had a jobs report come out just a few days ago, 313,000 new jobs. I think one of the things that impressed me the most was the labor participation rate
right.
increasing. How significant is that? And just give us the general picture and forecast for the economy through the eyes of Wells Fargo.
Yes, so Wells Fargo is a nationwide bank. Most of our business is here in the U.S., and so what happens in the U.S. economy is not only important to our customers, but it's really important to our company, and we're in a variety of different businesses. I would tell you that what we're seeing in terms of what our customers are telling us through surveys of consumer customers, our wealth customers, small business, and then more anecdotally with our larger corporate customers, is there's more optimism and enthusiasm about the economy than there's been for a number of years. We've had this tremendous recovery that's now the second longest in U.S. history, which is terrific, but it's been relatively muted across the entire country, and it seems like it's picking up a bit. I think the tax reform, which you know everybody's got a different view on it, but it will put more money into the pockets of Americans, and one of the things that Americans are really good at, and that's spending money when they gets in their pockets, and that's going to fuel economic growth, and we're starting to see that now in terms of metrics that we look at Wells Fargo. It's not even across the country, that's mm-hmm. for sure. There are some industries that are more challenged than others. But I would also say, and I think it's one of the continuing challenges that Detroit has, and that is there's still a swath of Americans that have not benefited from the recovery. And we've got to focus on those, in particular, those Americans that want to work that haven't come back to
exactly.
The job market. And I think we need to do more, Wells Fargo is continuing to do more in terms of reinvesting in the communities to be very focused on that. But I think overall, our expectation this year is that instead of an economy that's growing at somewhere between 1.5% and 2% gross domestic product growth, it's going to be more like 2% to 2.5%. And that makes a big deal in terms of the number of jobs that get created in this country.
It should also be pointed out that Wells Fargo was one of those companies that in the aftermath of the tax reform vote, reacted very quickly in relation to your employees.
Yeah, so what we did is that, make no mistake, we were a big beneficiary of tax reform. The reason for that is that over the last 5 years, we've been the number one, two, or three largest taxpayer in the United States. And so when we looked at the benefit that we were going to be getting from tax reform, we thought about how we could impact various stakeholders. Our most important stakeholder is our team members. I think we've got the best team in the industry. Many of you are here today. That comment is in lieu of compensation, so sorry about that. But seriously, we've got the best team. But when we looked at how our team was being compensated, we realized we had to do more for our lowest paid team members. So a year ago, before tax reform, we raised the base rate of our lowest paid team members by 12%. And then once tax reform was passed, we brought everybody that was below $15 an hour up to $15 an hour. That affected about 20,000 people. And then right now what we're doing is we're looking at the wages for those folks that were around $15 an hour. We'll be raising their pay, and that will affect another 50,000 people. And so we're reinvesting in our team. One of the other things we did is, and again, it's a very important stakeholder for our company, because we know we can't be successful unless the communities that we do business in are successful. We've been a very generous company. We've been a very generous company for the 30 years that I've been here. And we said, you know what, we're going to raise the bar. Last year, we gave $286 million and reinvested in communities, nonprofits across the country. We're increasing that by 60% to $400 million this year. And then we went one step further and we said, from now on, so beginning in 2019, if we are more successful, we are going to be even more generous and reinvest even more in the community. So 2% of our after-tax income is going to be reinvested in communities. I think more major corporations in this country need to do that, right? And so we're very focused. And many of the Fortune 500 companies and others that are not Fortune 500 companies that are located here in Detroit set similar goals for themselves. But you know, our view is that if we were going to benefit, if our shareholders were going to benefit, we need to make sure that we spread it across as many of our stakeholders as possible.
Yeah. The ship of state in Washington right now is being captained by a guy that likes rough waters, apparently. And are there any things on the horizon that concern you, be it the prospect of tariffs, mm-hmm. or perhaps the termination of NAFTA, mm-hmm. That gives you pause in terms of your optimistic viewpoint?
Yeah, well, I think that we've all got to be mindful about what's going on in Washington, because it affects what we do every day. Candidly, I think sometimes people in Washington think they have more impact on us than they really do. Mm-hmm. I think that people in Washington who we elect need to be a little bit better listeners sometimes to their constituents across the board. The things that I worry about are things that really can fundamentally impact the economy, whereas tax reform, I think, was a good step in the right direction to make this country more competitive. We were losing jobs, right, to foreign countries. This state is probably one of the best examples of that, unfortunately. Now, that's turned around, but it was happening everywhere. So tax reform was very helpful. Unfortunately, I think some of the current trade actions are potentially counterproductive there. NAFTA, for all of its weaknesses, and there are certain things that need to be improved in NAFTA. I think the Canadians would agree with that. The Mexicans would agree with that too. But we'd also look at that pact and say, this has been one of the most successful economic arrangements in world history. Right? We've got this incredible benefit in North America that we're separated from everybody else by two oceans. Right? We've got three countries, the three big countries in North America, that even on a bad day really like each other. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, Canadians might be better in hockey, and Mexicans are better in soccer, but we still like each other, right? Except for the Red Wings. Sorry about that. But we've got this. We've just got this tremendous opportunity to continue to grow these three economies in a very, very peaceful way. And the worst thing in the world would be to somehow blow up NAFTA. Now, our president's negotiating style is different, to say the least. He's very forceful. Very direct, Right? That shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. That's how he got elected president. But the way he's going about it, I think, is different and unsettling for everybody. I am more optimistic. I was in Washington the last couple of days and spent some time on this issue, and mm-hmm. I'm more optimistic today that NAFTA will get, they'll reach an agreement, and then hopefully it'll be improved. As it relates to, you know, the other trade negotiations, I think it's just a lot more complicated because there are more countries involved. But it certainly, if in a really negative scenario, could have an impact on the auto industry, which would be a problem for this economy.
You and I both came out of college about the same time, and we remember when a dollar in our pocket was year to year worth about 15% less.
Right.
We also remember when the interest rates were double digit, and we were looking at this thing called stagflation that I don't think anybody younger than 50 in this room had ever heard of before. Mm-hmm. Are we now heading towards something like that again? When you look at the level of deficits, especially the tax reform, while it's been beneficial, certainly wasn't revenue neutral. How do you foresee the impact of the incredible escalation of the deficit and our debt on the economy going forward? We may be extending the recovery, but is there a brick wall at the end?
There could be. One of the things I learned being in banking for 30 years is that I'm not very good at figuring out what's going to happen 5 and 10 years from now. So take what I'm about to say with a big, big grain of salt. I do worry about the deficit long term, not for our generation, but for our children and our grandchildren and their children. It's not sustainable. We've doubled our deficit in the last 8 years, right? If you think about how old this country is, in the last 8 years, we doubled it. It's owed to a lot of people that aren't in this room. That's not necessarily a good thing. I think the solution to it is not necessarily to take a hard right or left turn and reduce benefits to folks that really need them in this country. I think the solution to it is to take a very long-term 50-100-year approach and think about how to save a little bit every year to start to pay off that deficit. Right, I think that would be very important. Again, I don't think it's a big short-term problem. I think it's a longer-term problem. In terms of interest rates, I think it's likely that the Fed will continue to raise short-term rates because we're in a growing economy. I think they should have done it a while ago, mm-hmm. But they're, I think, doing a very good job. The new chairman of the Fed, Jay Powell, is just a terrific business leader, and I think he's going to do a good job in that role, and I don't think he's going to do anything that's going to create too much volatility, but I think short-term rates are going to go up. I think long-term rates, which one measure of that would be the 10-year Treasury, tend not to get set by the Fed anymore. They get set by long-term rates around the world and what's going on in Europe and what's going on in Japan. So I think it's less likely that you're going to see a big spike in long-term rates, but I think over time our rates are going to go up a little bit. But your point is important, Guy, because I think we've got to put the growth in rates in perspective. When my wife and I bought our first house or condo, it was in Chicago, I remember the interest rate on that mortgage was 9.75%. And you know what happened when we got that mortgage? The sun came up the next day. People went to work, right? The Cubs lost again that year, right? But the point is that we survived and we figured out how to operate in that environment. Right. I don't think the rates that we're in right now are historically incredibly low. As long as they don't rise really quickly, really fast, but it's more of a gentle and gradual increase, I think folks can adjust, and I don't think there'll be that big of an impact on the economy. As it relates to inflation, I think that's a much more complicated issue because I think the way that we measure inflation is a historical way that's not really accurate in terms of the impact of how technology is impacting all of our lives every day. We're able to deliver goods and services so much more efficiently mm-hmm. than we ever have, and that's also impacting types of jobs and the number of jobs that we have. And I think technology is going to have more of a muted effect on inflation than we think. So I think it's likely that inflation will go up a bit over the next few years. Short-term interest rates will probably rise, and long-term will probably rise a little bit less. But I don't think it'll have a negative impact on economic growth.
We're about to see incredible disruption in the automotive industry with the advent of autonomous vehicles.
Yeah.
We're probably going to see it in trucking first. Mm-hmm. As someone pointed out to me the other day, those that are in the auto insurance business, once you have an accident-free vehicle, all of a sudden could be pretty lonely people. What disruptive things coming down the pike are rattling the antenna at Wells Fargo?
Yeah, so when we think about banking is a boring business, right? And generally bankers are boring, right? I would agree with that, right? So there's this view that in the
only Lisa disagreed. Did you notice that?
Actually, she agreed.
Well, okay. Yeah. I take that back.
Yeah, but when I think about the financial services industry, and for the 30 years that I've been in it, we've been going through innovation every year. In fact, I like to say and remind people at Wells Fargo that we started in business now almost 166 years ago, delivering people and packages by horse. That was our business model. You know how long that worked? Not very long, because they invented the railroad, right? And then they invented the telegraph, and so on and so forth. We've been innovating in this country for as long as we can remember. I think the pace of innovation has increased. So when we think about how we're going to introduce innovation at Wells Fargo, it's that particularly for our consumer customers, we need to think about them not on a product-by-product basis, but on a relationship basis. We need to be able to deliver products and services to them so that they feel like we know them and we have a relationship, whether we're talking to them in person or whether we're talking to them over the phone or online or via the mobile device. So our focus is to make sure that all of the ways that our customers interact with us are connected. We're not there yet, but we're making a lot of progress. And we're focused on making sure that the customer experience that they have is not just the best in banking, but it's got to be the best in any product or service that they happen to buy that day. Right? That's who we're competing against. If somebody has a bad experience on mobile with Wells Fargo, it's not because they think Chase or PNC or B of A, all great banks, by the way, have done a better job. It's because they just had a better experience at Facebook. That's who we have to think about. And that's so we centralized all of our innovation group, and we've allocated more money to them, and we've got them focused on increasing the pace of innovation. And in the last year and a half, we've doubled the pace of the innovation that's going on at Wells Fargo. It's a really, really exciting time to be part of the industry. Having said that, we're also very mindful of the fact that not all the best ideas come from people at Wells Fargo. Right? One of the things that I think we've learned and the changes we've made in the last couple years at the company is we've said, you know what, if we've got a great idea, terrific, but maybe some of the best ideas are outside the company. Maybe there are some folks we want to partner with. Maybe there's folks that we want to have a joint venture with. Maybe there's some folks we want to invest in or buy. And that's how we're thinking about innovation.
Last night, Senate passed Dodd-Frank reforms. I know that they don't affect you directly because it's mostly aimed at banks, $250 billion in assets and down. Mm-hmm. But does that change the competitive landscape? And is it a good move?
First, I think it's a really good move. And the reason I say that is because many of the reforms that were passed post the Great Recession that have impacted the financial services industry were good. Many parts of Dodd-Frank were absolutely appropriate. Should we have liquidity rules? Should we have capital rules? Absolutely. Should we be operating in a more customer-friendly way? You bet. But right? When you think about the systemic risk that a large firm has on the economy versus a smaller, and when I say firm, I mean a bank, like Wells Fargo, versus a medium-sized and small firm, it's just different. So there should be different rules. Right? And I think it's really appropriate that medium-sized and small banks in this country don't necessarily have to operate with all the same rules at Wells Fargo. We don't necessarily look at that as a competitive disadvantage because one of the competitive advantages that we have, in addition to having the best team in the industry, is we have these incredible economies of scale. Mm-hmm. Right? We can invest $7.5 billion in technology each year. Right, some of that going into innovation, some of that going into cybersecurity. So we have this incredible benefit of economies of scale, and I think leveling the playing field a little bit from a regulatory standpoint to give medium-sized and small banks a bit of relief is the absolute right decision.
You talked a little bit about Wells Fargo history, mm-hmm. That the wagons don't come through here as often anymore. I know if I'd be remiss if I didn't say from Mayor Duggan, you know, we would enjoy having an aggressive presence here in Michigan. What is your relationship with Michigan, and are there opportunities for growth?
Yeah, so we don't, as I mentioned, we have some a small retail presence actually in the northern part of the state, in the Upper Peninsula in northern Wisconsin. Our business here is our wholesale banking business, so think about it, commercial real estate, middle market lending, small business lending, large corporate, things like that. Our mortgage business, which again is the largest, notwithstanding what Dan Gilbert said in his recent commercial, is the largest in the country. Dan's a good friend and a terrific competitor and a big customer, so I say that.
And an MSU guy.
Yeah, well, my younger brother made that same mistake too.
Okay.
Yeah. Though I did pick, sorry, Mark, I picked Michigan State to go farther than Michigan in the pool.
Oh. We'll see.
Yeah. I mean, I hope they don't, but, you know, I wanted to win the pool. Yeah, no. We'll see. And then we've got a terrific wealth and investment management business here in the state. And that works for us. And we think that we want to grow every one of those businesses. We want to continue to be very focused in the community. Last year, we gave almost $1 million to nonprofits here in the state. Our team member base contributed thousands of hours of their own time in terms of volunteering for causes that they care about. So it's been it's just a great place from our perspective to do business.
Yeah. Let's talk about the last 18 months.
Yeah.
There's a big elephant in the back of the room, so let's address it, and that is. Obviously, 2 million unauthorized accounts, some big fines, a lot of regulatory attention from the Fed and from many other quarters as well. Where are you in the rebuilding effort? And let's start first with you. You learned about this. You had been a member of this organization. You believed in the culture. You believed in the people. Mm-hmm. How hard was it for you to hear about this? And what do you do in terms of restoring your own trust in the system and the people you're working with?
Yeah, well, it's more than the elephant in the room, that's for sure. The first thing is we needed to be very clear about taking responsibility for any mistakes that we made. And that's one of the first things that I did when I became CEO. I had a town hall with our team in Charlotte, and I was very clear that the leadership of the company had let our team and our customers down, right? So that was one. Two, we needed to be very self-reflective and to fix anything that was broken. In our retail banking business, as you mentioned, we had an incentive plan that had gone off the rails. We got rid of that incentive plan. We have a new one in place, and it's working. We had some leaders in the company that had not followed the culture of this company, the vision, the values of the company, and they had to leave, and that was hard. We had to look at how the company was organized, and we fundamentally changed the way that we were organized. We created the innovation group. We created the payments and virtual solutions group. We centralized all of our enterprise risk and control functions, including technology and risk and human resources and finance and so on and so forth. And then we needed to step back and say, you know what, we're going to look at every product and service an operation that we have in the company, and we're going to make sure that we're doing things correctly. And if we're not, we're going to raise our hand. We're going to be very transparent about it. We're going to fix it. And if there were any customer that were impacted, we're going to make it right by them. Right? That, unfortunately, doesn't create a lot of great headlines. Right? Right? It just doesn't. Because what you're doing is you're highlighting errors that you made. Right? That's a tough short-term challenge that we have. The good news is that while we're working through that, this incredible company, because of our people, are performing unbelievably.
And they've stayed. Let's talk a little bit. I mean, when the boat starts leaking, the biggest concern is you're going to lose the good ones that can move. What has happened at Wells Fargo since, and what kind of lessons can be drawn from it?
Well, when I stepped into this role, my biggest concern was that we had a team member base about 260,000 team members that had lost their trust in Wells Fargo because we had made mistakes. Right? So what do we need to do? We needed to listen to the concerns that they had about the company, and we needed to communicate differently with them to make sure that their concerns, I probably get 10 to 20 emails a day from team members providing their concerns. I ask them to do that. An entire leadership team does that. We communicate more frequently. We provide them with updates. We listen to them in terms of compensation. I mentioned some of the changes that we made. We listen to them in terms of some of the concerns that they have about how we interact with our company. And we made fundamental changes in the company to react to what they were worried about. Because you know what? No matter how important I think my job is, the people that really understand what's going on in Wells Fargo are the ones that are dealing with our customers each and every day. And what I'm excited about is that as we survey our team, they're happier in terms of being at Wells Fargo. But it's beyond just surveying, right? What's the best way to determine whether or not somebody's happy with their job? It's how they do it and whether or not they stay, right? So when I look at the customer experience scores or customer loyalty scores that we're now seeing from our retail bank based upon the changes we've made, they're now at some of the highest level we've seen. They're not as high as I'd like them to be, but they're certainly back up to what we saw before we had our retail banking issues that you had mentioned. More importantly, I look at turnover or attrition. The turnover, meaning people wanting to leave Wells Fargo, is down to its lowest level in 7.5 years. Right? Now, I think it's because they like working for this CEO. I'm smart enough to know that that's not the case. What they're telling us is that they believe in the company, they believe in our vision, they believe in our values, and they believe in the changes that we made, and that's really rewarding.
But you had to change the culture, and that's one of the hardest things to do, and Mary Barra knows something about it down the street. Mm-hmm. It takes years. So how has that gone, and how patient do you have to be? Because you've got an awful lot of folks sitting in another part of your building watching.
We do. We have lots of people that are watching, sometimes too many, to be honest with you. So one of the things that we did is we surveyed our team. We did a very exhaustive culture survey. And just step back for a minute. One of the big challenges that I have when I talk about culture is that culture means different things to different people. Google the word culture, and in 0.45 seconds, you will get 2.2 billion references. Factor out the bacterial cultures and science cultures, okay? That's about a quarter of them. You still have a lot. Everybody's got a view on culture. Everybody's got a view as to what the definition of it is. When I think about culture in a company, first I think about, do the people in the company, right, believe in the vision and the values of the company? So we surveyed our team, right, and we asked them that question. And you know what they said? They said, we love the vision of this company. Satisfy your customers' financial needs and help them succeed financially. That's what it's been for decades. That works. We asked them how they felt about the five primary values of our company, right? They loved them, right? What we needed to do is we needed to organize folks a little bit differently and get them very focused on six aspirational goals, and then we needed to look at all the practices that we had in the company. That's what I think about about culture. And so what we did is we took a 38-page vision and values handbook, which we used to live by at Wells Fargo, and we realized that 38 pages is too many pages to get every 260,000 people on the same page. And you know what we did? We put it on one card, right? The vision, the values, and these are our aspirational goals that we introduced, right? I have this because I carry them on my wallet. I'll give you one, guy, so you can
remember
Wells Fargo, right? But if what we need to do at Wells Fargo is to get everybody focused on that vision, those values, and our goals, and to make sure that we're treating our customers appropriately, and we'll be absolutely fine. And we're on that journey.
How do you navigate, though, when you've got the Fed's boot awfully close to your neck and really restricting your growth? This is a growth-driven business. So how are you going to navigate that? And do you think things will get better by September? I know that's a big date for you.
Well, so we are unfortunately under what's called an asset cap at Wells Fargo. Our balance sheet at the end of last year was $1.96 trillion. It's a little bit of change, right? The Fed Federal Reserve has said, until you fix certain things at the company, which, by the way, we completely agree that we need to fix, you can't grow that balance sheet. That doesn't mean that we can't serve our customers. So within that $1.96 trillion balance sheet, we can make some changes in terms of some of our deposits, not consumer deposits, not commercial deposits. We can make some other changes, and we can continue to grow the loan portfolio. As I mentioned, our loan portfolio is about $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. We're the largest lender in this country. We love lending money. We think it's critical to the growth of the economy. We can continue to grow our loan portfolio. We can continue to take consumer deposits. Is it a little bit more difficult? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We will get through it. We'll address their issues, and we'll move on.
We've got so many business people in here that are probably wondering, look, with the reputation that Wells Fargo had, mm-hmm. how could this have happened to you? What's the biggest takeaway? What was the biggest lesson that you've learned over the last 18 months about what ball was dropped, or what, obviously there was an incentive program that was too aggressive, but beyond that, right. how were the signals missed?
Well, I think that part of the reason that, Guy, the signals were missed was that a few years ago we were organized differently. We were organized on a business line by business line basis. And each of the business lines had its own finance department and risk department and HR department and compliance and so on and so forth. So when there was a problem in one of our businesses, the business leader and the business worked really hard to try to fix it. In this case, in our retail banking business, they didn't move fast enough, they didn't escalate it as quickly as we could, mm-hmm. and it got, unfortunately, out of control, right? So that's one of the reasons why we fundamentally reorganized the business so we have better checks and balances. That's one. I think two is that when we had a problem at Wells Fargo, sometimes we looked at it based upon the percentage of mistakes that we might make. Right. Which, so if I said to you, I'm going to get something right 99.95% of the time, you would say, that's pretty good, right? I would. I never got an A. And I don't know why. You guys were all A-plus students. I don't know what's going on. But at Wells Fargo, given our size, and I'll give you a data point, in the fourth quarter, we had 2 billion customer interactions.
Wow.
Right? So if you get a 0.5% or 0.05% of those wrong, tens of thousands of people don't feel good about Wells Fargo. Right? So we had to fundamentally change how we think about managing the business, that it's not about percentages, it's about percentages and it's about numbers and it's about people. And then the other lesson learned is that when you have an issue, you need to make sure that you're also collecting data about that same or similar issues and put them together. So we would collect information about customer complaints, but we didn't match it up to turnover in the business. We didn't match it up to growth in that business. We didn't match it up to a lot of other data points. And now we collect all that information and we look at it at the same time. So if there's a minor issue, you can get to it more quickly and as opposed to letting it fester. So those were the mistakes we made. And candidly, those were very painful mistakes. Right? But we've realized the changes we need to make to the business, and we're in the process of making all those changes.
And we know you're working really hard at that, and I'm out of time, but yeah. One last question. Where do you see Wells Fargo in 12 months?
We're going to be further along on our journey. I think we're going to be, the 6 goals that I set out for our company are to be the best in customer service and advice, innovation, team member engagement, risk management, our commitment to the communities, and then long-term shareholder value.
In other words, you're focusing on the things that you can have an impact on and that you
Absolutely.
Can control, not on the things that you can't.
You know what? You can lose a lot of sleep worrying about things that you have no control over. Right, and we all need to get a lot.
So if you take care of this, you think the regulatory issues will eventually fix themselves?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Appreciate
your candor.
You bet. Thank you. You bet. Yeah. No?
Right. I know. He can't go.
You can stick around if you want, or you can take a seat, Guy. It's up to you. But
I will let Tim do this, fly this one solo. But thanks very much.
I'm still struggling being the 13th. Speaker on the state.
That's always my mom's lucky number. Don't worry about that. That's okay.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start out, Tim, by asking you a question that you probably don't get in other parts of the country.
How did growing up in Michigan help shape the way you viewed the business world as you progressed upwards?
So my father was in the auto industry, and one of the things that I learned early on is that there are economic cycles, right? And we're all going to go through them. And it's been very helpful for me, because when I think about the way that the financial services industry was operating in 2006 and 7, you were hearing phrases like the new paradigm, or we're not going to have recessions anymore, or somehow magically there have been potions that have been, you know, spread across the country, and everything was going to be all right, and everything, all we were going to do was go up. Growing up in Michigan, the thing I learned is you have cycles. You're not smart enough to know when they're going to occur, but you better plan for them to occur so you can get through it. And once you get through it, it creates bigger opportunities than you can imagine. Now, the two Wells Fargo examples I would give you is our company had our biggest growth in the two most difficult economic cycles this country has ever seen, the Great Depression and the Great Recession. So if you plan for cycles, it creates great opportunities. And one of the opportunities is you survive.
One of our students asked a question. What developments in technology have the greatest potential to impact the banking industry?
I think one is data and how we collect data in a good way. That sounds a little bit George Orwellian. Sorry about that. But how we can collect data in a way that can efficiently put our customers in a place where we can respond more quickly to your needs and to help you succeed. The one I would give you today is in our mortgage business. We've introduced a new mortgage online application. I don't know how many of you in the audience have had a mortgage before. Is one of the most annoying things you do when you fill out a mortgage, you just say, well, wait a minute, don't you already know all this information about me? Has that ever happened to you? Right? So we've solved that at Wells Fargo. If you're a Wells Fargo customer and you come in and you apply for a mortgage, we pull all the information using all that data that we already know about you, and we get the application done in minutes all by ourselves. Right? That's a way that technology can make all of our lives a little bit better and create a better customer service experience.
So I usually make it a habit not to ask questions that are beyond my level of understanding, but this is a really good and important one. How do you see blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies impacting the banking system and the banking business over the next 5 years?
I'm glad the question was asked that way. Differentiate between the technology and the currency. There are 250 cryptocurrencies in the world today, not just Bitcoin. They're all over everywhere. I'm personally not a big believer in cryptocurrencies. One reason is that most of them are used today by people that are doing things that are dishonest, right? I think if I ask for a show of hands in terms of the number of times, you may have bought the Bitcoin for crazy speculative investment, but you don't use it to pay for things. And that's the way it's going to be. Right, and so I look at that in terms of who's using it, and then I also, historically, using my University of Michigan history education, look at why are currencies believed in. Right, why would you use a currency? Because you believe that it's got the backing of a strong government, a strong economy, the rule of law, and a military. I don't see that with Bitcoin. Right, it's a tulip. Right, that's what it is. Now the technology, completely different. Distributed ledger technology, and I'm going to dumb it down because it's the way I understand it, is really basically when you make one change, right? It's that that information is spread across a number of different users immediately, right? And it's very secure. So we have somewhere between 15 and 20 different projects that are going on in terms of how to apply that blockchain technology, and we're not the only company that's doing this, but how you apply that blockchain technology to different types of transactions in banking. It could be trade credit. It could be credit default swaps. It could be settlement of title settlements. There's all kinds of ways when you think about applying that technology to make to bring down costs and to make things more accurate and efficient. That's really exciting. That'll happen over the next 5, 10, 20 years, but it is very exciting.
How quickly, Tim, can you identify a leader inside your organization? And is leadership something you're born with, or can you actually develop these skills?
We spend a lot of time on leadership development in Wells Fargo, and we've been, more programmatic about it over the last few years. We've told our leaders what expectations are. We actually put it on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, so there's no mystery about it. One of the things that I've learned about looking at leaders is you really never know how good somebody can be in a leadership role until they have a challenge. There were a number of people at our company that I thought were terrific leaders, and then we went through some of the challenges that Guy and I were talking about, and they didn't stand up. They couldn't handle it. Right? They were really good when things were going well. Well, I think anybody can be a good leader when things are going well. But when things are tough, that's when you learn how good leaders can be. So it's learning from your mistakes, learning from your challenges, being more resilient. That to me, that's much more important in terms of leadership skills. I don't think leaders are born. I think they're made based upon the experiences that they face.
Great. Do you believe the federal government invests enough money into innovation? And if not, what do you wish they would do?
I think that the federal government should invest in innovation based upon the value that they provide to us. And I think that when you look at, and you can all decide what areas of the federal government you think are valuable or less valuable. I don't think we should be looking to the federal government for the most innovative ideas. I think we should be looking to the private sector, and that's where most of the innovation should be. And I think we in the private sector have to do a much better job of sharing that innovation with the federal government, not the other way around. Not that there's not great ideas out there, but there's so many challenges that our federal government has today. We shouldn't also foist upon them the responsibility to be innovative in this country. I think it's the responsibility of the private sector.
Another student question, Tim. What do you think about the big firms that recruit only from targeted schools?
Well, I don't agree with it. I mean, I think we recruit from hundreds of schools around the country. And we do it based upon the experience that we've had in terms of hiring students from those schools. And having said that, we put very high expectations on the schools that we recruit from, and we are very clear that these are the types of folks that we want. We want to make sure we have a very diverse set of applicants. And we hold them to a very high standard. And I think it's a real mistake to only, with the exception of University of Michigan, of course, Mark.
But that would have been your second strike, by the way.
I know. I was trying to figure out how I was going to get out of the hole there. I started my company. But I think we have one of the important changes that's going on in this country today is how we're all reacting to the fact that the demographics of this country are changing. If you just recruit from a certain set of schools, you're probably going to get only a certain set of students. I'd rather recruit from a variety of different schools that we've had good experience with, so we get a diverse set of team members, and we're much more inclusive with that team member base.
Good. Another student question. How is the transition from being a chief operating officer to being a chief executive officer change your daily work routine, and what were the differences and the major challenges you faced at those top two positions?
Yeah, it's we were going through a transition at Wells Fargo when I was named to be the chief operating officer. that if I performed well in that role, then over a year and a half or 2 years, I would likely be in the role that I am right now. But because of the challenges that we faced in the fall of 2016, that was accelerated into a couple of days. So it was a bit abrupt. And I wish it had never happened that way. I really do. The difference in the jobs is that when you're the CEO, there's nobody standing behind you that you can check in with, right? Everybody's looking at you. And it's just, you just gotta get used to it, that's all. It's a little bit different, but boy, I am so blessed to be part of this company.
That's great. So I think we'll move on, Steve, to the lightning round. Okay, a new tradition here at the club, relatively new.
Wait a
bunch of quick, short answer questions.
There's no such thing as a new tradition.
Well, a new soon-to-be tradition.
Okay. Am I a guinea pig here? Is this where we're going? Okay.
See, now I'm going to ask you the hard ones.
Okay.
So, first, Tim, something on your bucket list?
To spend more time with our grandchildren.
That's great. A person you'd most like to have lunch with?
Actually, I'm one of the benefits of being CEO at Wells Fargo is I get to have lunch with our largest shareholder once a quarter, which is Warren Buffett, and that's a lot of fun.
One of your favorite songs?
Born to Run.
Generational?
Yeah.
This is a question...
It's coming back.
Yeah. This is a question that'll allow you to make up for some lost credit. What was your favorite team growing up?
Other than the Michigan Wolverines?
Ding, 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 ding.
Okay, thank you. Detroit Tigers.
All right. Your best sport?
My best sport, none of the above. In fact, some of my high school classmates are here, and they'll recall my lack of prowess in almost every sport that I played. But I did. I looked really good on the bench of the basketball team and the soccer team.
Outstanding. The last book you read?
The new Lincoln biography by Ron Chernow. Yep. It's a tome. It's 1,000 pages. But if you want some leadership lessons, read that book.
Yeah. Yep. Your favorite movie?
Oh, I'm going to embarrass myself. Animal House.
Yeah. Your favorite character was Dean Wormser?
No.
No. Your go-to website?
Oh, ESPN. Other than WellsFargo.com, I assume, yeah, I would probably say that, yeah.
Favorite vacation spot?
Oh, gosh. Probably Northern Scotland.
Wow, that's great. And, you know, last question, actually. What advice would you give your 25-year-old self?
Don't take yourself so seriously.
Thank you very much,
Thank you.
Tim.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tim Sloan. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you. Tim, thank you for coming all the way from California to be with us. President Slissel, thank you so much, Go Blue, for your outstanding job as presiding officer. Guy Gordon, professional job moderating, no surprise there. Thank you for your time. Mary Beth Howe and the Wells Fargo Michigan team, thank you for your support of this event. We really appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, great to be with you. This meeting is adjourned.